I'm actually going to spend a little bit of time. There's a few things I want to mention here before we get too far into our sermon this morning. One is, and it didn't end up making it into the bulletin, I'll make sure to send out an email as well, or maybe we'll put it on the Facebook page. But don't forget, we do have our annual business meeting. That's going to be on the 20th of November. And what we're planning on doing currently, unless there's some real strong dissent, is that we're going to go ahead and have our morning service. It's going to be somewhat abbreviated, the morning service. We're going to follow that morning service with sort of a potluck, Thanksgiving-style get-together gathering. Because I really liked the way that you guys were so pliable after food. So we're going to do this. Just kidding. We're going to go ahead and let you guys eat, and then we'll spend a few minutes after that there during the morning time. Just going through the annual business meeting and just kind of give you a picture of where things are at. We're going to go ahead and have those financial reports available to you ahead of time so that you have a chance to review them, make sure there's no questions that come up. Please rest assured, and this is something I just wanted to say before, like I said, before we get too far down the path this morning, we really want this to be something where, again, this is a partnership. That's how I perceive membership, is that it's a partnership. So don't misunderstand the fact that we're presenting you with the financial reports through the finance committee or through the deacon board. The thing is, this is a partnership. If you have any questions at all, we want to answer those questions. If there's any confusion, if there's a situation where you think, I thought this was one way or the other, you're a partner in this. You need to know, because this is part of what God is doing in this body. So if you have anything that comes up, or if there's any reason why you have any concerns at all, let me know, let any of the deacons know. We'd love to answer those questions for you. Fair enough? Just want to make sure that that's obvious. I think it was, but just in case it wasn't. You guys don't usually have a trouble asking questions, though, so we're okay. But just in case you felt concerned. All right, well, let's go ahead and get started this morning. And we remind ourselves once again where we've been. Now, I know you all got the notice that if you would have shown up early, I would have already, you would only miss the introduction, whatever. I know now that you would have had to do your own introduction. My apologies for that miscue that I gave my sister. Regardless of that fact, I'm going to go ahead and actually this morning I'm going to move pretty quickly through our introduction, partly because there is a lot that we're going to cover this morning. It's a very theologically rich section of Scripture. There's a lot of content, so strap yourselves in. We're going to move quickly, and I know when you think that and you consider me, I mean really fast because I already moved quickly. So just as a reminder, and again, we see this every week, but we've got to remind ourselves every time, the true gospel will only always reflect God's glory. And we've established that that is really the heart of what Paul is presenting to the Galatians. Last week, we looked at what we called the gospel, not legalism. And we talked about the fact that there is really, ultimately, the question that comes up as a result of this content that Paul puts forward is that there's really no way that anybody can live under the law. There's no hope for those to perfectly keep the law, and that's exactly where he wanted you to come to. The law is not about doing, or is about doing. So the law is this rules. This is sort of your checklist that you have. It's not about believing. Believing comes only by faith, and that's the distinction that Paul wants people to understand, is that there's a difference between doing and believing. Believing will result in doing, but it's born out of faith. It's not born out of an adherence to a law or a legalistic standard. Instead, it's saying, because I believe, I am then therefore tied in faith to Christ, and his goodness, his grace, and his mercy is what propels me forward to do what people would commonly call Christian work. All right? And we talked about that a little bit last week as well. Additionally, we pointed out the fact that there is a strong distinction. Well, first there was this lie, and then the lie was sort of being permeated throughout the church there, and they were insisting that the Galatians needed the law to do good, to be good Christians, and they were depending that by doing that, they're denying the sufficiency of Christ. Adding anything to Jesus makes him a step, not the destination. Remember, we talked about the fact that if you add something to the process of the gospel, it moves Jesus from the destination, the goal, the objective, into just one of the many steps I take to get to heaven. And that is not at all. It's a very, very evil lie that actually pulls Christ off his throne, which is really one of the things that the devil wants to do from the beginning, right? He doesn't want God to be on the throne. He wants to be on the throne. So when he adds stuff to this, and when he encourages us as believers, as children of God, to turn Christ into a step in the process of the gospel, he is actually accomplishing an incredibly evil thing through us, if you think about it. Christ is the destination. He's the objective. Anything else, being good Christians, will pull Christ off that throne. And one of the ways that we illustrated that was the fact that you have these two different warring factions between legalism and licentiousness. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But the first question that inevitably comes from this is, do morals count? Does it even matter? Am I supposed to do anything good? If the implication of this is that it's all about believing in faith, then apparently good action doesn't matter. And people will use this argument. They used it back in Paul's day, and they use it today. They say, okay, if you preach too hard on grace, people will just find it as license. They'll just go and sin freely. And I understand where they're coming from. I mean, pragmatically, you can't help but look at trajectory, right? Trajectory in thinking is an important part of rationale. You look at what you're thinking now and you say, okay, a logical extension of your thinking could end up leading you in this direction. That's a good, appropriate response. However, you need to understand that a true understanding of grace and a true comprehension of the incredible mercy of God will not drive you to more sin, but will instead drive you to awe at the fact that God in his goodness has given you the ability to avoid sin. Do you see the difference? There's a whole different difference in perspective. Suddenly I move from, oh good, I'm free to do what I want, into, oh good, I'm free to serve and love God. And as a result of that, I'm just astounded that I have the privilege of experiencing his mercy and grace even as I encounter sin in my life today. And as I find myself struggling against that temptation, I can go back to the passage that says there is no temptation taking you, but that which is common, men have experienced. God is faithful, who will not suffer you to be tempted more than you're able, but he's going to give you the opportunity to escape that you might be able to bear it. What is the essential action word, or what is the thing that really is the pinnacle of that argument? God is faithful. Do you see how it all points back to him and his faithfulness? If instead I'm saying, oh man, but I'm strong enough, and you've worked out your salvation sufficiently that you have strong spiritual muscles, so therefore you can resist the temptation, I guarantee you, friend, that will not last long. Because apart from the faithfulness and mercy and grace of God, we are all inevitably going to fall flat on our faces. That's just the facts. But God is faithful, and in his grace and mercy, he has given us an opportunity to escape the bondage of sin. I do not have to sin any longer. What an opportunity. What a privilege. What grace. That's the difference. And it's the fact is that this argument that many people make misunderstands the essential element of grace, all right? So we talked about that last week as well. And remember, this is where we said legalism is attempting to do what only Jesus can do. And licentiousness, or this loose living, is acting as if Jesus didn't need to do it. In both cases, you're taking Jesus and saying, he's not the important one. I am. Either I will do it because I will try to make myself strong enough to be, you know, a good Christian. And that is, again, it's turning Jesus into a step and putting me on the throne. Or in the other case, when people say, well, I can just do whatever I want, the implication of that is that there is no justice, there is no judgment, there is no holiness. Suddenly, all the things that Christ came to redeem us to in the cross are unnecessary. If it's true that I don't have to live a good life, if it's true that I don't have to live according to the principles and precepts of the Word of God, if it's true that none of that matters and we're all making it to heaven anyway because it's just God is a loving God, well then suddenly Christ is unnecessary as well. So both of them remove Christ on either side, and that's why the middle is where it matters, all right? So we discussed this a little bit more as well last week, followed finally with this concept of a curse for us, and this is really where Paul kind of hangs his argument. Christ became a curse for us, the curse for us, taking all the weight of law's curse on himself. It is by faith. Faith is what provides us with that opportunity for somebody to become our curse. We are cursed as a result of the law. We are under the curse of sin. It's astounding to consider the weight of guilt that's against us. Christ became a curse, the curse on our behalf. And by faith, I tie myself to Christ. I say, in faith, I accept and trust in the fact that he is faithful. He is reliable. He is dependable. I am putting my faith in the dependable nature of Christ and of God himself and saying, that is what is going to save me from this curse. Not my own actions, not my own adherence to certain doctrines, not my own legalistic addition to the necessary means of grace. Instead, what I am saying is, I will tie myself to Christ. He is my faithfulness, and he has also become the curse for me. So that's where we spent our time last time. This morning I want to talk about the gospel and covenant, and this is going to be a very interesting discussion. I'm excited about this morning's section of scripture. So let's go ahead and turn to the book of Galatians, chapter number 3, and we're going to be discussing verses number 15 to 18. This is the next section. So we just finished up 14 last week, so now we're pushing on into 15 to 18. Galatians chapter number 3, verses 15 to 18. And I want us to really consider for a minute exactly what is implied in some of this section. So let's read it. Galatians chapter 3, verses 15 to 18. Paul says, to give a human example, brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it has been ratified. Now the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring. It does not say, and to offsprings, referring to many, but referring to one, and to you, your offspring, who is Christ. This is what I mean. The law, which came 430 years afterward, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God, so as to make the promises void. For if the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by promise, but God gave it to Abraham by a promise. This is reading out of the ESV, and we're going to spend, I want you to start there, and then we're going to go back into the NASB, because both of them really join together well to help us understand what's going on here. What's your initial reaction to what we just read? What is the genre that we just examined in terms of, if I read this out loud, what would you assume that I was reading from if it weren't scripture, of course? What does it sound like to you? Sure. So it's based on the previous portion where he said we are all part of the recipients of the inheritance that of the promise of God to Abraham. Absolutely. Yeah, so it's tied to his argument. This is not an extenuation of some different argument. That he's going back to that argument that says by faith, because of our DNA, our faithful DNA, that we are part of the family of Abraham. Absolutely. In the covenant of Abraham. Sure. Now you're thinking too spiritually still. Yeah. It's legal jargon, is it not? Does it not sound like something that you would hear as, you know, somebody is, according to the ratification of 0.3174 of Article 7, we need to establish the, and it just sounds legalese. It's supposed to, okay? Don't be surprised by that. This is legal argumentation. Paul is actually taking a very clear argument here that comes from a legal sense that he's actually been very well trained in, consequently. Paul was not some, you know, fly-by-night guy that got his credentials out of a Cracker Jack box. He had a depth of understanding. He had a legal precedent that actually permeated a lot of his arguments, and this is one of them. He's incredibly articulate in expressing the legal ramifications of this particular covenant that's been presented. All right? So that's really where it's coming from. So let's take this piece of apart piece by piece. The reason that he makes this presentation, I think, is because a possible objection is going to inevitably be raised by the people who have encountered the argument up to this point. Remember, when we said this already, throughout chapter 3, he is essentially answering the arguments that are presented by these Judaizers, by these men, honorable men, people that have great credentials, who have stolen into the church and are trying to say, no, it's not just faith, it's faith and Judaism. That's really what they're saying. You have to be faithful to Christ, and you also have to have a Jewish sign that you actually have joined into the membership or the clan of the Jewish nation. That is what they're saying, and they're making a very compelling argument to this group. And Paul is saying, no, I insist that you listen to the true arguments of the Word of God, and he's saying, this is the thing. This is the most important thing. And he's trying to address the arguments that might come up. So here's the argument. This is the argument that he addresses. Well, okay, fine. You say that Abraham, you know, I don't believe what you say about the covenant being available to everyone, because that's just foolishness. There's no way that God intended for everyone to experience the blessing of Abraham. But fine, if we give that to you, whatever. So you're saying it's just by faith. But here's the thing. If it's just by faith, Paul, if it's just by faith, explain to me why 430 years after the covenant of Abraham, Christ or God introduced this covenant of the Mosaic covenant, right? The covenant of the law. Hey, what are you going to do with that, Paul? What about the Mosaic covenant given that much time later? Why else would God have added a law with 600 plus rules this time after if he did not intend to make it crystal clear that we must go beyond this view that you're presenting, Paul, of Abraham and exert our own effort and in this way earn our right to the inheritance? This is going to be the argument that's going to come to their mind. Is this a logical argument for them? Sure, why not? Does this make sense that this would be what they'd think? Absolutely. In their minds, they're saying, okay, fine. You say it's all by faith and grace. What's the deal with the law? Huh, we've got you there. 600 plus rules, man. And it says we're supposed to do them. It says we're supposed to do all of them. And in fact, last week we talked about the call and response, about the curse that's presented as part of that law. That says if we don't follow each piece of this law, we are going to be cursed. We are going to be, we're going to lose the blessing of God. I mean, the thing is, it seems like God is saying, okay, never mind. Maybe it started by faith, but now we've added the law. Does that sound familiar? Sure, it started by faith with Abraham, but the law was added. What do you do with that argument? Paul presents a very compelling dissection to express the difference between the Mosaic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant. And I want you guys to just be focusing on that this morning. Is there a difference between the Mosaic covenant that was presented in the Old Testament and the Abrahamic covenant? Does this matter to you? That's the first question I want to answer. Because already I can think in my mind, if I was sitting in your shoes, I'd be like, what? I'm no Jew. What is this guy talking about? Mike, you're really going off the deep end. This is not very interesting. It does matter. Why does it matter? Because you are in. If the argument that Paul has presented is accurate, anybody who accepts faith, like Abraham's, is in the covenant of Abraham. So this is sort of like, when you buy a car, I know, I'm a car salesman. When you buy a car, I had to walk you through the arguments or the essential, this is what you get out of this deal. You get 60 months of paying $850 a month. I'm sorry, friend, it was a big truck. And, this is the responsibility that you're going to have. This is the things that happen if you don't do it. I need you to initial here, sign here. Did you recognize this? Are there any questions you had on this piece? This stuff matters, doesn't it? Now, a lot of people are like, oh, but I have the truck. That's all I care about. But it actually matters that you understand what are the ramifications of this covenant. What are the ramifications of this argumentation that's presented? This matters, okay? This is part of who you are as a believer. All right. So this argument, let's talk about the objection, and let's figure out how he answers the call of this objection. The first is in Galatians chapter 3, verse 15. This is where he starts. And he says, brethren, this is in the NASB, I speak in terms of human relations. Even though it is only a man's covenant, yet when it has been ratified, no one sets it aside or adds conditions to it. All right? So he starts out, and this is one thing I want to point out. What does he do first? The first thing that he does is he says this, brothers. All right? Why does that matter? In light of what he has just gone through, what did he call them five verses earlier? You foolish idiots. All right? That's really what he says. He's like, you dummies. How could you possibly think this way? So he's been pretty hard in this section. And now he's reminding them that this is not just Paul the iron fist. He's saying, look, we're brothers in this. Brothers, please understand this. So he's endearing himself to them, reminding them that this is not him being angry always, saying, brothers. Brothers, come on, you know this. I speak in terms of human relations. Let me bring it down for a moment here. So I want to talk to you about a human relationship. Even though it is only a man's covenant, yet when it has been ratified, no one sets it aside or adds to it. What's he talking about? What man's covenant? What? Say what now? Basically, this is your last will and testament. This is what he's talking about, right? The reception of the inheritance, the last will and testament. In fact, that word testament from the Greek is the same word that's translated as covenant. So this is a very comprehensible term for us, the last will and testament. Now, some people immediately jump to the concept and say, well, come on, this is a dumb argument, Paul. You can change a last will and testament, right? Sure you can. I mean, I may say for a while, man, I'm best buds with Keith. He's the coolest. Keith is the coolest, man. What's up, Keith? And I'm best buds with him, and we're hanging out, but then he brings my pizza cold. And it's like, that's it, and I scratch out. I was going to give you half the house, but forget! I'm changing it. I don't want this anymore. I'm going to give it instead to Max, because Max, like Max now. You can change that covenant. So this is a dumb argument, right? What's being expressed here? It talks about it being ratified. How do you ratify a last will and testament? What makes a last will and testament unchangeable? You die! All right? At that moment, what happens? It goes from a document that can potentially be changed to, it's set in stone, is it not? Can anything be changed in the last will and testament after death, no matter how much you wish it were? No, it's been ratified. It's been established. Now that the person that wrote it is dead, there's no hope. And so if the cat gets all the money, the cat gets all the money. I'm sorry. I wish there was something I could tell you. The cat's going to have an enjoy it, but you might want to work for the cat. Here's the thing. Once they've ratified that covenant, there's no hope. There's no hope to change it. That's what Paul is arguing here. He's saying, this is a human document. This is something that we're making a covenant between humans, and we see it as unchangeable. How is it possible that you could argue that the covenant that God made with Abraham can be amended? That's the argument, right? The Abrahamic covenant was established. And then 430 years later, the Mosaic Covenant comes along as an addition, a little, oh, well, God might have got it wrong initially. So we're going to go ahead and add to this covenant of faith, this covenant of law. Is that possible? What would happen if that were true? God would cease to be God. He changed, right? It is impossible. We as humans know the importance of a true and ratified agreement. How much more would a holy God keep his word? So that's his argument. He's saying, if you really want to say that God added to that covenant, the Mosaic Law, you've got a very difficult conundrum, because God has now changed from who he was. And that makes no sense. So he starts there from this argument of the last will and testament sense, all right, in verse number 15. And he wants to make that very abundantly clear. So this irrevocable trust agreement that God made with Abraham is described in three terms. We're going to talk about three terms that you see in verses 16, 17, and 18. There are three essential terms that he has presented this covenant, this irrevocable trust agreement that he made with Abraham, all right? And the first term is that I want you to look at the beneficiary of the trust. The second is the date of the trust. And the last is the condition for inheritance. These are the three terms. I know, sounds legal. It should. It's supposed to. That's what Paul's doing, all right? Three essential terms that he wants you to understand about this covenant that was made with Abraham, all right? And he's going to compare it to the covenant of the Mosaic Law. Galatians 3, verse number 16. Now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is, Christ. What is this in reference to? The promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. Where do we find the covenant there expressed? Where is this covenant, the terms of this agreement, written? Does anybody know? So it's with Abraham, so you can kind of, yeah, Genesis would be a good place to start. I'd assume it's probably Genesis. Most likely not until at least chapter 6 or 7, right? Because before then, there's a lot of real early history going down. It's actually in Genesis chapter number 12, where he establishes this covenant. And part of the wording of the covenant, we're going to examine this in a minute, but part of the wording of the covenant implies to his seed. All right? Now, here's a very important thing that you need to understand. And that is why he makes a point of it here. He says, okay, I'm going to define this for you people. If he would have left it without adding this little commentary, he does not say, and to seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed, that is Christ. If he would have just stopped right here in Galatians 3:16, said, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. You know what the Judaizers would have said? That's right. Ha! Paul, you're arguing against yourself. We've been saying this all along. It's only to those that are part of the seed of Abraham. Now, I know you take seed to mean spiritual DNA and whatever, but No. Seed is the actual direct descendants of Abraham. That's where the covenant rests. But Paul wants them to even see beyond the concept of the universal nature of the offering of the promise and covenant of God to any who are faithful to him and believe in him, but also, and to your seed, that is Christ. He is essentially making the argument that the covenant that was made to Abraham was fulfilled fully in one person. Christ, which is a really kind of an interesting concept, especially for them. So let's take this apart a little bit and understand a little better where this argument's coming from, all right? All right, so this is the beneficiary. This is what we're talking about, the beneficiary of this trust covenant, this irrevocable agreement that was made with Abraham. And he uses all this commentary on seed, all right? Man, I have it like 15 times. That's cool. When the Old Testament authors, or when the New Testament authors comment on the Old Testament passage, they do not give an interpretation, but the interpretation. The New Testament interprets the Old. I want you guys to think about this with me for just a second. So what he starts with is he says, okay, this argument, this covenant to Abraham was made to him and his seed. And then he adds commentary. Let me express what the seed is. And he gives them a description of it, all right? Often, we assume that that's like the interpretation of it, or an interpretation. And in fact, the people who are hearing this might be thinking, okay, well, that's one way of looking at that. I mean, we've been taught this our whole life, Paul. We've been in the synagogue, and we've heard the scribes and the Pharisees and those that are teaching us, these rabbis told us what this was. And now you're defining it in different terms. You're saying, okay, the seed is Christ. What? Well, that's just your interpretation. And some of us can slip into that same thinking, right? But here's the thing I want you to understand very clearly. I believe in teaching the whole counsel of God. And that includes Old and New Testament. When the New Testament provides commentary or a further understanding or description of the Old Testament, the full understanding that comes through the New Testament is the interpretation. Does that make sense to you? There was a veil that was placed, and Scripture talks about it repeatedly, over the full comprehension of what the Old Testament is accomplishing. Not until the New Testament authors came and lifted that veil as Christ tore that misunderstanding in two and said, this is what it all meant. That's when the full comprehension comes into play. Let me give you an example. I want to show you how clearly this is seen, even through Christ and his own description of certain things. I'm going to take you to a few places in the Gospels, all right? But first, I want you to look at a verse in Malachi or Malachi, depending on who you are. Malachi 4 verse 5, behold, I am going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. I am going to send you this guy named Elijah, all right? That was the thing that they heard from the Old Testament. That was what was being taught. That was what was being expressed by the rabbis, all right? Okay, perfect. Without the New Testament, we would understand this to refer to a second coming of Elijah before the second coming of Christ. That's what it seems to be implying, does it not? I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. Without the New Testament to inform our thinking, that would be our only thought. That would be the only real conclusion we could draw because it seems very clear that that's what's being expressed. Let me take you to a passage in Matthew 17, verse 10. And his disciples asked him, saying, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? What are they referring to here? This is on the Mount of Transfiguration. They have encountered the second coming of Christ, essentially, or the first coming in his full form, right? And they're saying, okay, wait a minute, I don't get this because the scribes have always said that Elijah was going to come. And now you're saying that you're Messiah, but we have not had Elijah come yet. I don't understand. And his disciples are presenting this argument from their own understanding or comprehension of the Old Testament. Fortunately, they're asking the right person. See, the disciples, they're confused because they thought the order was messed up here. When Christ is presenting himself as Messiah, they're thinking, uh-oh, this doesn't make sense because it doesn't fit with what we've seen in the Old Testament. Christ answers their question in that same passage in verses 11 and 12, and he answered and said, Elijah is coming and will restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah already came and that they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they wished. So also the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Oh, now wait a second. Now Jesus says, guess what? Elijah's already come. Say what? Elijah's already come? Are you sure you know what you're talking about here, Jesus? He's saying that they didn't even notice it was him. They didn't even recognize him. Who was Elijah? Very good. I'm glad you guys know that. The disciples knew the prophecy about Elijah, but they didn't understand that Elijah was a type or a representation that was fulfilled by John the Baptist. The prophecy in Malachi was actually fulfilled, but it was not physically fulfilled. John came in the spirit of Elijah. You see that actually throughout a lot of the descriptions of him. Luke 1:17, and he who is going as a forerunner before him in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn back the hearts of the fathers to their children and the disobedient to the attitude of the righteous so as to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. John came as a type of Elijah. He was a representation of the answer there. John 1:21, and they said, what then? Are you Elijah? And he said, I am not. Are you a prophet? And he answered, no. All right. So is it a physical manifestation of Elijah? Was John the Baptist really just Elijah, kind of in a weird form? No, he's not actually Elijah. See, that's the thing. The New Testament provides insight and understanding into the Old Testament. All right. Matthew 11:13, and you guys get it. Matthew 11:13-14, for all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and now if you care to accept it, he himself is Elijah who was to come, all right? So the New Testament gives us a description and a better understanding of what it is that we're encountering. Man, I have a lot of duplicate slides. That's so weird. Maybe I'm pushing the wrong button. All right. So back to Galatians 3:16, we see that in this instance, when Paul says this is to the seed, which is Christ, he's giving them a full understanding of what has been prophesied. This is very necessary for us to understand as well, because otherwise it's going to become very hard for us to wrap our minds around the fact that this is what it's referring to. I want you to notice this. Now, the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. Consequently, let me talk about the word seed for just a second, all right? So if I told you, let me just give you a better perspective on this. I don't, maybe you don't need this, but I needed it. So I'll offer it up, and then you can laugh at me. If I want to go and say I'm going to buy seed at Gully Greenhouse. It's the only greenhouse that came to my mind. Gully Greenhouse, I'm going to buy seed. All right, well, fantastic. That's great. All right, so I walk in, and I said, I need seed. And they'll say, well, what kind of seed do you need? Well, I need cucumber seed because, man, I'm telling you right now, the Jamindans, man, they had cucumbers, and I want to match that bumper crop, so I need some real seed. So, okay, great, and they give me a packet. Shake that thing, like, yeah, there's seed in there. I can hear it all right? But if instead I said, I want a seed, wouldn't that, it's the same word. Seed can be plural or it can be singular, correct? How do I define the two? There's this descriptor, there's this addition that says, I want a seed. I want your biggest, best pumpkin. I just want one seed. I want this thing to be monstrous, you know, so that I can copy Google and I can have my own, you know, pumpkin that I carve for my homepage. The thing is, that is a much different thing. Seed can be either one. Sheep, same thing. Hey, look at all the sheep. Look at the sheep. Which is it? One? More? I don't know. There's a collective sense to what's being expressed here. That's part of what he's trying to do. He's saying, hey, pay attention, people. There's more than just seed as a general sense here. This is actually an individual seed. This is through one man. And in fact, in the ESV, they actually talk about offsprings versus offspring. They're trying to get you that sense of the collective nature of what's described. They're saying, you can't think, the offsprings is not an actual word, is it? It's like offspring can still mean multiples or any, but they add that in there because they're trying to help you to see his argument. He's saying this does not have to refer to many. It can refer to one. Second thing I want you to notice is the promise, all right? There is a difference, a very marked difference between a promise and an agreement, okay? There is a marked difference between a promise and an agreement. And that's really what he wants them to identify as they think through this concept of the beneficiary of the trust that is presented here. There's a marked difference that he wants them to see. Promise versus agreement. Now, here's the thing. If I go to Naomi and I tell her and Nikki, I promise I'm going to take you out for ice cream because I know that you guys have been wanting to go hang out and eat ice cream. So I promise, Daddy promises I'll take you. Oh, yay! And they're all in the backseat. Hurrah, hurrah. Well, we have a few errands to run between the ice cream shop and there. And in the process, they become very, let's just say, boisterous. And I turn back to them and say, listen, you guys, I told you I was going to take you to ice cream, but if you guys don't stop messing around back there, we're not going to be able to go. What is going to happen? I guarantee you, I could put a stack of $100 bills on this one. Naomi will answer with something along the lines, and probably in very shrill terms, but you promised. I set it up as a promise. I said, this will happen. There is no sense of, well, maybe if and or. An agreement says, if you're good, I'll take you to ice cream. A promise says, I'll take you to ice cream. There's no conditional aspect to it. There is a very key difference between the Mosaic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant in that regard. And that's what I want you guys to realize. That's what Paul is trying to help them to see here. This is about promising. God has promised to Abraham this covenant, this agreement with him. And it is very key that we see that distinction. In Genesis, remember I told you 12 verses 2 and 3, this is the terms of the agreement, the covenant that he made with Abraham. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you. And the ones who curse you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. All right? That is the agreement, the promise that was made to Abraham as part of this irrevocable, unchangeable promise that he made. I want you to turn over, and I want to actually talk a little bit about Genesis chapter 15, verses 5 to 18. I'm going to read this for you. And the reason, again, that we're going through this type of detail is not because I want to bore you, but because this matters to you implicitly. This is about your salvation. 15, verses 5 to 18. Let's read it together. And he, being God, took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars, if you are able to count them. And he said to him, so shall your descendants be. Then he believed the Lord, and God reckoned it to him as righteousness. And he said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. And he said, O Lord God, how may I know that I will possess it? So he said to him, bring me a 3-year-old heifer and a 3-year-old female goat, and a 3-year-old ram, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. Then he brought all these to him, and cut them in two, and laid each half opposite the other. But he did not cut the birds. And birds of prey came down upon the carcasses, but Abram drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. And God said to Abram, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you will be buried in old age. And then in the fourth generation they will return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete." And it came about when the sun had set that it was very dark, and behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, "To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt as far as the river Euphrates." All right? So I'm going to stop there, and I want to describe to you exactly what's happening here. This is a significant thing, and we don't comprehend this at all. Truthfully, this is so far removed from our comprehension or understanding of a ratified agreement that it's very important we understand exactly what God was doing. We typically seal something. It used to be with a handshake, a firm shake, saying, "Yes, I recognize, flesh on flesh." We acknowledge this to be a truth. If you ever study the history of the handshake, you'll discover there's a lot more that's meant there even in that sense than what we even know now, but it's fascinating. But regardless of that, let's study out what's going on here. So he says, "I want you to get this 3-year-old cow and a goat, and I want you to take them, and I want you to split them in two. I want you to cut them literally down the middle and in half." And this is what they would often do. They would set it on an incline, and they would take these halves of animals on this incline, and they would allow the animals to literally bleed out into the center, and that would pool toward the bottom of the incline. I know it's kind of disgusting when you think about it, but track with me. At the conclusion of this process, typically over a period of time, there would be a pretty significant amount of blood that would be there. And then the stronger of the two people that were making the agreement would step through that blood and walk between the pieces of these animals. And the point of that was to demonstrate, as the blood splashed up onto their ankles and onto the hems of their garments and things like that, there would be a recognition that, "May my blood be spilt in a similar fashion if I break this treatise." Basically, it's kind of a macabre thing, but they wanted the blood to be on them to make them realize this is a blood oath. We hear that too, you know? The whole concept of it, there's a depth to this agreement. This is not just pinky swear, okay? This is a big deal. And that was what was supposed to be represented. And then typically after the stronger of the two people would do it, the weaker then, the person who had less ability to fulfill and ratify that treaty, would then do the same thing. All right? And that would typically be how they would seal these agreements. Does that happen in the case of Abraham or Abram? No, it doesn't. What happens? God self-ratifies. Only he passed through. He was the only one, as represented by the flaming torch in this oven, to pass through and ratify this covenant. This is a promise that requires no, you know, work on the part of Abraham. He is merely the recipient of this agreement. It's very important that we perceive that, because that is a key part of the difference that people weren't getting in the Galatian church. They didn't understand the fact that this was a self-ratifying treatise. This was God saying, "I promise this about you, and you have no responsibility to add to this covenant. It is my covenant with you." Astounding. The God of the universe chose to self-ratify this promise. All right? The Lord himself cut a covenant, is kind of how it can be described. And we see that in Genesis 5:15. So then in Galatians 3:16, like we said before, and this is actually in verse number 17, even though it says 16. "What I'm saying is this: the law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise." Do you see what he's saying? Do you see how he's tracking in his thinking? He's saying it is impossible for us to say that this law that has been given as a call and response, "If you do this, I will bless you. If you don't, I will curse you." That is an agreement. A covenant, as represented by the Abrahamic covenant, was a promise that cannot be invalidated by anything but God himself. This time God made an agreement, not a promise, with Israel. This agreement that he makes is the law. This agreement demanded certain responsibilities of each party to the agreement. The Mosaic covenant does not invalidate the Abrahamic covenant. So what then is the point of the Mosaic covenant or the agreement with the children of Israel as part of the law? What's the heart of that? What's the purpose behind it? He is basically at that point saying, I need to point you to the fact, because you have already misunderstood my promise to Abraham. And I'm going to give you this. Okay, fine. This is a whole separate issue. You want to think you can make it yourself? Here's the rules. Follow these 600 plus rules. And tell me if you get to the same thing that I've already given you freely. You follow these rules, you follow the curse that comes from this, and see whether there's any comparison between working and getting payment for your sin and making a payment for what you've done wrong and receiving a free gift that was self-ratified by God himself that required no input or requirement from you. You tell me which is better. They have completely opposite trajectories. They have completely opposite intention. Fine, you think you can do it yourself without my promise? Give it a shot. Tell me how that works for you. And discover the wonder of the covenant that I'm offering for free. This blessing that will be yours forever if you merely accept by faith my seed, Christ. Galatians 3:18, if the inheritance is based on law, it is no longer based on a promise. But God has guaranteed it to Abraham by means of a promise. If this inheritance is based on law, if it's based on following the works of the law, it's not a promise. It's not. It has no foundation on promise. It's based on you deserve it, right? If I follow the law, then I deserve it. If I meet every standard, then I get what I get freely. I've earned it. It's payment for my work. It's no longer a promise. It's payment. The promise that comes through the Abrahamic covenant is only by means of God himself. So this is really what Abraham wants us to grab a hold of. And in fact, if you look at Exodus 19, verse 5, this is where he's ratifying the covenant of the Mosaic law. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, and for all the earth is mine. If then, right? If you do this, then this is a whole different perspective on how they come to Christ. All right, there's a conditional. This is what I'm calling the conditions for the inheritance. What is the condition for the inheritance that we receive from God through Abraham? What is the condition? There is none. It's unconditional. As I accept by faith, tie myself by faith to Abraham, and am counted as righteous as a result of my trust in the dependable sacrifice of Christ, I now have an unconditional agreement with God. All right? So why does this matter? Why is this important for us to understand? We get why it's important for these people to get. You know, obviously we know what their deal is. They were trying to make this argument for the law. Why does it matter to us? Did you guys know that the gift of God was free, unconditional? Of course you did. We know that, Mike. Why'd you just spend so much time? Why does it matter? You have to tell me. I'm not telling you. Why does it matter? It affects our perspective of God, absolutely. Why else, Twyla?
Well, it completely changes things.
Absolutely it does, doesn't it? Yes, sir. You can't. No matter how hard you try. Say what? We've already broken the law. And we continue to break the law. To what? Yeah, it's a curse. It's an absolute curse, the law is. We'll never get there. Bonnie? That's the point. Which is why we continue to live by grace. This is where the rubber meets the road for us. We get so locked into this mindset as Christians. I've started by law, or by grace, I mean. I've started by this free gift. I know it's a free gift. I know I don't deserve it. That's the message we tell people in the gospel. You cannot earn your way to heaven. Okay, I need the grace of God. I need his mercy. I need an unconditional covenant to change my status. And we start there, and somewhere along the line, we transition back into, I follow the rules and regulations of the law, as if somehow I am making myself better. Somehow I am making myself a good Christian. Somehow by following these rules, I will endear myself to a holy God. That is impossible. You cannot do that. If you have started by faith, and have tied yourself faithfully to your father Abraham and to the seed that came through Abraham, Christ himself, and if you have attached yourself to him as your only hope, how dare you step back into this realm of the law and say, I started by a free gift and I'm finishing by my own guts, my own strength, my own sweat. That will not be effective. Instead, what it will do is it will distract people from the gospel. There is a reason why there is only one gospel. And the reason you must understand that gospel is because your life is preaching the gospel. Your actions are communicating to the gospel to those around you. If they see in you this whole concept of I'm receiving payment for my good labor and am somehow becoming better before God, they are going to miss the gospel. You're preaching the gospel to yourself and others. This matters. You need to understand what it is that you have received. There is a gift character that this inheritance is offering. It's this character of a gift, a free gift of God that has been given. It cannot be received as payment for keeping the law. This logical argument is developed by Paul to drive home his rebuke for the stupidity. That's what he called it. The stupidity of viewing something as a payment, which has already been received as a gift. There is a stupidity to reviewing and seeing something as payment for your actions, which you have already received as a free gift. Don't be stupid. That's his argument. Don't be stupid. That's our challenge. So this morning, what I want you to do is I want you to really think through what exactly it is that you're living by. What is your gospel living communicating? Are you communicating by the way that you approach your rules and standards? Are you communicating by the way that you approach your relationship with God and with others? Are you communicating by the way that you see the gospel, that somehow you are getting your just deserts? You are getting what you deserve by your actions. Or instead, is your life and character permeated by the sense that living a true gospel will point every single person back to the fact that I can't do this by myself. It is God and his glory that I'm looking to reflect, not my own glory, not my own action, not my own good spirit or good motives or any of those things. This is God and his glory that matters most. All right? So let's take a few minutes here. Bonnie is going to come and she's going to play number 371. But if it's all right with you, let's just go ahead and not sing. Instead, I want you to bow your head and close your eyes, and this is why. I want you to be very introspective about how you've approached the gospel. Go ahead and bow your head, close your eyes, and ask honest questions from God about what it is that you are doing with the gospel. If somebody looked at your life, looked at the way that you lived, would they be pointed to an unconditional covenant agreement, promise from God himself that has redeemed you and saved you and is restoring you to relationship with God? Or instead, will they see a good Christian, a moralist, somebody who is receiving payment for good action? We need to have a passion for God and His glory in our living and in our understanding of what it is that we're receiving through the gospel. Set my heart, O dear Father, on Thee and Thee only. Give me a thirst for Your presence divine. Lord, keep my focus on loving Thee wholly. Purge me from earth, turn my heart after Thine. A passion for Thee, O Lord, set a fire in my soul, and a thirst for my God. My prayer, Lord, Thy power impart, not just to serve, but to love Thee with all of my heart. God, thank You so much for Your love. Lord, I pray that You'll help us to focus our time and our energies on reflecting Your glory. Lord, set our passion not just on service, but, Lord, on a love for You that is evident in the way that we live. Thank You, God, for the amazing grace, mercy, faithfulness that You expressed through this covenant that You gave to each of us through Abraham. Lord, I pray that our hearts will be pricked, be burned within us as we consider Your great grace. In Your name we pray. Amen.